Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Welcome to the show on this Friday, along with Lauren Gilger and Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Whether we've caught you in the car, heading to a mega sale, or lounging at home avoiding the crowds, we're glad you joined us today. This is a special show with some of our favorite stories, all with a nod to the shopping some of us do on Black Friday, the family we've been surrounded by this holiday, and the technology that gets us from store to home.
Up first, let's revisit a conversation about cars, or really the future of cars. You've seen the Waymo self-driving cars stopped at intersections. You've probably seen Uber cars in your rear view. Well, here's another name entering the Valley's self-driving arena, the Institute for Automated Mobility. Governor Doug Ducey announced the new organization in October.
There's a lot of questions that still need to be answered. And of course, our first priority is always going to be public safety. But I think that this is reflective of what our philosophy is we know that it is not the government that creates these technologies and these ideas, but it is the government that wants to ensure public health and public safety.
So the Institute for Automated Mobility will be a collaboration between government, the private sector, and the three state public universities. Intel is the only private sector company involved so far, and it played a key role in designing the Institute's structure and mission. We're joined now by Jack Wiest, senior principal engineer at Intel. He works on automated vehicle standards there. Jack, good morning. Jack, you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. So, best case scenario to you, what comes out of this new Institute?
Well, I think the focus of the Institute on safety and collaborating with government and the state universities and consumers to really try to answer some of these currently unanswered questions about how do you know when to give an automated vehicle a driver's license? What does the driver's test look like? And how do we work together as industry with state partners to figure out the answers to these questions?
Given all of the testing that's been going on Valley roadways and all of the different companies and projects that have been going on here, is it maybe a little late to be just starting to think and work on some of these issues?
Now, the timing is great, actually, and we've had a long research partnership with Arizona State University. And so this Institute for Automated Mobility is an opportunity to bring together a lot of efforts that have already been going on between industry and academia and state government partners, and bring it under one house so we can accelerate the completion of the work so we can bring this technology and improve the lives of everyone across Arizona.
How optimistic are you that other private companies like Intel will join in?
I think we're very optimistic. The feedback we've gotten already from the announcement the Governor Ducey made last night has been phenomenal. We certainly can't share any names at the moment, but you should definitely expect some powerful brands that we all know and love to join the center soon.
Well, and what's interesting about that is that we've read for so long that the companies that are working on this technology have been very proprietary, very secretive. They don't want people to really know specifically what they're working on because they're nervous about their particular secrets and technology getting out. Do you think that companies, will Intel, for example, be willing to share what it knows with other potentially competitor companies?
We absolutely are. And the reason is we feel that safety is something that shouldn't be left up to proprietary chance. We think that the safety of automated vehicles and the safety of the decision-making of those vehicles and how they drive on these roadways is a challenge that's much bigger than any one company, and is something that can only be solved together as an industry in an open and transparent, technology-neutral manner across ourselves, our customers, our competitors, government, academia, consumers, all of us looking at this problem together and agreeing that, yeah, that's the right way I'd like that automated vehicle to operate. And yeah, that's the right decision for that automated vehicle to make in that kind of scenario. So we've actually opened up a key innovation that we've created at Intel called the Responsibility Sensitive Safety Model, which is a starting point for this conversation. It's a formal model for how decisions can be made safe in an autonomous vehicle. And we are very happy to share that with the industry in a completely open and transparent fashion.
So does that mean that on matters of safety, maybe you and other companies will be willing to collaborate, but are there still areas where you still kind of want to keep your stuff sort of, you know, behind your shoulders there so other people can't look over and see what you're working on?
Absolutely. You know, market differentiation is still important. Brands of vehicles are important, and our customers still want that brand identity. And so differentiation in terms of the in-vehicle experience or what other kinds of drive or ride features is all opportunity for the market to be really creative. But at the end of the day, I think what we as an industry have an obligation to do is to ensure that there is a basic level of safety across all brands. And so that consumers can trust the safety of an automated vehicle, regardless of what brand or service operator is operating that vehicle.
All right, so Jack, the million-dollar question now, quickly before we let you go. How close are you, and how close maybe do you think some of the other companies are, to having these ready to go on roads, not in testing mode, but in actual driverless mode?
I tell my friends and family that it's closer than you think. And I think the last puzzle is to work with regulators and consumer groups to establish that trust, prove that it's safe, so that we can deploy these vehicles widely for all to enjoy.
All right, that's Jack Weiss, Senior Principal Engineer at Intel, working on automated vehicle standards there. Jack, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Shopping malls have been an important part of the Valley for decades, going back to the years when the name Goldwater was associated with politics and department stores. But as more big box stores are closing and more consumers are shopping online, malls are having to change what they do. Stephen Totten used to cover retail for the Phoenix Business Journal, and last summer we talked to him about whether retailers want to stay in or relocate to malls. He said business owners have mixed feelings about the once prominent shopping locales.
There's definitely a sea change going on in retail, and that definitely hits home here in the Valley, where, you know, we've been so used to shopping malls all the time. And, you know, maybe back in the day, it was the ideal place to open your store. That's not so much the case anymore. And I spoke with several different local small business owners, and a few of them said, sure, a mall would be a good idea. But most of them were fairly skeptical about opening a location in a mall.
And where did that skepticism come from? What were they concerned about?
Well, you know, you got the normal answers like we'd want to have high traffic, we'd want to have ample parking, and one could argue that those things are still existent in shopping malls. But really the biggest issue, I think, comes down to rent. And that's because opening a brick and mortar in a shopping mall is incredibly expensive. Take a place like Scottsdale Fashion Square, for example. That's probably one of the higher end, if not the most high-end mall in the Valley. When they had Barney's open there, every store that was surrounded by Barney's had to pay a higher rent solely because Barney's was there. Now, that's not the case anymore because, as you know, Barney's closed. But just because of the nature and fashion of the mall, it's definitely pricey to open there.
Yeah, rent is obviously huge. What about freedom to some extent, too? Because in the mall, place like Fashion Square or others, I would think that there is also a different sort of responsibility or expectations from your landlord that you can maybe even, let's say, over the holiday period, I've heard this as well, like over the Christmas time, maybe you don't have enough employees and you don't want to stay open until 11 or midnight, but those are the mall rules, so you've got to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you open in a shopping mall, you have to follow certain protocols that you would not be able to do in a normal shopping center or another retail location. And for a lot of small local businesses, they don't have that kind of capital or amount of employees to sustain that kind of model.
You know, we talk about local first in general, and that's obviously a big thing here in the Valley and around the state. How much does that sort of fit into the mindset of malls? Are there some business owners who just sort of feel like maybe even if I got foot traffic, it's not the vibe that I want for this particular business?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of malls tend to shy away from local businesses just because they don't have that kind of reliance that maybe a bigger national brand name would have. But there are some shopping malls who are leaning toward local first. So, for example, Uptown Plaza is probably a great example. They have a nice blend of both national and local retailers that complement one another. Desert Ridge is going under a renovation, and they're having a big focus on local restaurants because they know that'll draw names. And then there was just an announcement about a new development in Gilbert's Agritopia. They're doing a mixed-use center, and their intention is to have almost all 100% local businesses. The only issue is you usually have to bring down the rent quite a bit in order to get those local businesses to be able to operate there.
So who's the mall shopper now? As malls try to get more shoppers to come back, because we've often thought about teenagers hanging around at the mall and maybe more affluent people actually buy stuff at the mall. Is that still sort of the case?
Somewhat. And it really depends on the mall you're talking about. If you look at somewhere like Fashion Square or Chandler Fashion Center or the Biltmore, those are definitely aimed toward the affluent shopper. Those people are still going to come in and buy things. You still may get the mall rats, but maybe not as at high of a volume as you did back in the 90s. But you still have, you know, teens going there and taking selfies or what have you. And so mall developers will kind of react to that by putting up a cool mural or something that would attract a social media user to go and interact with those spaces.
And did we just hear that Fashion Square is going to try another expansion?
They are. Fashion Square is undergoing a major expansion right now. I would imagine it's costing a lot of money. They won't disclose it. But it is all focused on luxury retail. It's all in their luxury wing. So speaking to the affluent shopper, that's who they're aiming towards. They're not looking toward these local small businesses. They're looking for someone who is going to charge a lot of money for their product because people are going to pay a lot of money for their product and likely pay a lot of rent to keep that business open.
Stephen Totten of the Phoenix Business Journal, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Odds are you've been at your local supermarket a lot this time of year as you prepare meals for the holidays, and you may have noticed grocery stores have come a long way from the days of the mom and pop in the corner grocer. Compared with 40 years ago, the markets where we buy our food now truly live up to the name super. The amount of items to be found on the shelves ranges from the everyday to the exotic, and we're exposed to food items we've never had access to before. KJZZ's Phil Latzman spoke with one man who explained the drastic changes we've seen.
Michael Ruhlman is the author of Grocery, the Buying and Selling of Food in America, and he joins us now with more on how they've changed over the years and how that's impacted our everyday lives. So, Michael, why have grocers gotten so much better?
I think one of the main reasons they've improved is because the consumer has asked them to improve. The consumer wanted better food. The consumer wanted different varieties of food. When I was a kid in Cleveland, Ohio in the 1970s, you couldn't get shiitake mushrooms or cilantro or anything like that, but now we can. It's a business where the grocer responds very quickly to the consumer's desires because there's such a low profit margin, they have to do that.
And in certain places, like here in Phoenix, we're actually, there's a lot of groceries and supermarket companies that are based here. Does it matter in a market, per market, as far as competition is concerned? If you have more competition in one market, are the supermarkets better? Have you found that in your research?
I've certainly found that some supermarkets are fabulous and some supermarkets are not. Some are dirty, some are badly organized, some are, you know, their produce isn't well stocked, they've got dust bunnies under the freezer compartments. The staff doesn't go out of its way to help you, that kind of thing. That makes a big difference when you're shopping. You know, I think a lot of the shopping now is because so many people consider it a chore, anything that makes you feel better when you're grocery shopping is going to enhance the experience. And a good grocer, certainly one in a competitive market, is going to be responding to that. If they can't differentiate by price, they've got to differentiate by customer service.
So what's the greatest impact that the new supermarket has had on our way of living?
Well, it's in many ways, it's sort of made it harder. We've created so many products that going to the grocery store can be confusing. So it's both confusing. We become more and more confused by our food. We don't know what's right and what's wrong, what's processed and what's not processed. There's some processed food that's good, like beef jerky is good for you. But, you know, cornflakes are less so. So it's given us a more variety, but it's also given us more confusion. So it's sort of a mixed blessing. But that said, I really want people to appreciate what grocery stores are and what they give us. They give us bountiful food for relatively little cost, and we're very lucky to have them.
Do grocery stores at all reflect our society as a whole? That maybe there's something to be said the way we've changed in the last few decades and our society has changed with it?
Well, sure. You know, it shows, you know, the gluten-free craze, which, you know, I think will eventually blow over. But that shows that we're, you know, we're less healthy. We don't feel as good. Grocery stores show us what we want because that's what we're demanding. We're demanding. It's showing a busier life because we're demanding faster food solutions. It shows us, you know, how much money we have and, you know, what we value. And right now, more and more, we're valuing whole foods that are better for us because we as a country have become sick by eating all this processed food.
How are supermarkets going to change in the future? And, you know, thinking about Amazon's recent purchase of Whole Foods and now the fact that you don't even really have to go to the supermarket for things. You could do your shopping online.
It's a big, big deal, and the grocery store is going to change. And I believe that all the commodity stuff, all the stuff in the quote-unquote grocery department, which is the center of the store, all the stuff that won't go bad, all the commodity stuff, all the stuff that is the same no matter where you buy it, that's all going to be delivered to us. And the grocery store is going to go back to what it once was, with a purveyor of specialty goods, a purveyor of very, very good meats and produce and wine and cheeses. And I think that bodes well for people who care about food.
I think it also says that maybe there's a brick and mortar business that has to be there. I mean, there's only going to be a few places we're going to be able to get fresh food to buy for dinner that night. That need, it seems like, would never go away.
That will never go away, and unless we can just have it delivered by Amazon in an hour, we're always going to need a grocery store nearby.
Michael Ruhlman is the author of Grocery, the Buying and Selling of Food in America. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. If you're online today, chances are you'll look for or be bombarded by sales from e-tailers. As online retailers like Amazon continue to show their retail might and shopping malls around the country are shutting their doors, it might seem like the days of brick-and-mortar stores are numbered. But according to Denise Yon, author of the book What Great Brands Do, there are still things that physical retail stores can do and are doing to bring in customers. And it's all about the experience. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about this and joins us now. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning, guys. So Yon says the best retailers right now have come up with ways to create extraordinary customer experiences. They understand it's not enough to have good products and to sell them at competitive prices, but they have to really create a multi-sensory customer experience when you walk into the store or when you log onto their website or see them on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or something like that, for that matter. So here's Yon with a few examples of stores she says are doing this right.
A couple of examples. You know, one is REI, the outdoor outfitter. Their mission is to bring the excitement and adventure of the outdoors to their customers. And so I think every aspect of their store design is intended to convey that, you know, the materials they use in their store, the ice pick door handles that you use when you first walk into the store, mm-hmm. get a real sense of the outdoors and the passion that the people who work for the brand have for the outdoors when you walk into that store. And then, you know, they offer all sorts of great merchandise and then lots of services, lots of experiences in terms of events, or they have REI Adventures, which is their tour company. So they're really kind of surrounding the customer with a distinctive, memorable experience. And then another retailer I point to is Sephora. You know, I think that they have done an excellent job of creating this place that is exciting and that customers like to go to try products and to discover new things. And, you know, they have a very kind of upscale feel, but their prices are very reasonable. And so I think that communicates a real value to their customers. And so in both of those examples, you know, I think that retailers looking beyond just selling the product to really engaging the five human senses, engaging the customer's emotions, and really telling a very distinctive story in their customer experience.
Yeah. Is this sort of a new phenomenon? Do you think retailers are sort of learning this lesson about trying to create experience around a shopping experience as Amazon and other sort of online retailers are really cutting into their business?
Yes, they've had to. They've had to learn the lesson the hard way, I think, you know, in terms of losing business to e-commerce players who provide the product, the price, and the convenience that they either had been or even better than they had been doing. And at the same time, you know, I think they've seen some of these you know, kind of newer retailers come into brick and mortar and shown people, hey, this is what a shopping experience should be like. In both cases, I think that the mainstream retailer has kind of woken up and realized that it's a brand new battlefield, really, and that, you know, customers' love and loyalty is going to be won or lost based on customer experience.
How much of this has to do you think, with this generation, with this, you know, 25, 20, 26-year-old generation, where you've got millennials who really are different than past generations and consume things in different ways than past generations?
I definitely think that it's been a big influence, not only to what you just said about how they are consuming products and experiences very differently from their parents. And, you know, I think that they have higher expectations because that's basically what they've been trained to expect now, but also because of their use of social media and the fact that a post by one of your friends who says, hey, I had this really fun time at the store or whatever, is going to be a lot more influential on you than an ad that a retailer runs. And so the influence of the social media that the younger generation is using also, I think, affects retailers in the sense that they need to provide this great experience that's worth sharing and worth remarking about so that then, you know, people find out about them through their friends.
I wonder, though, even as stores are trying to compete in this way and coming up with new approaches to doing that, are they really, though, going to be able to? Or is this going to inevitably turn into an online is king kind of market?
No, I do think that there is a definite role that brick and mortar stores play in culture and a real value that they create for customers. So I don't think stores are going away anytime soon. But I do think that the smart retailers, the ones who are going to succeed, use both online and offline and create a very seamless experience between the two so that their customers can shop them however they want, whenever they want, wherever they want. And so I think if retailers can bridge those gaps, they'll weave themselves into customers' lives very easily.
So do you think that in this battle back and forth between brick and mortar and between online retailers or those businesses that are doing both well, is the consumer the one who's really going to win here?
Yes. I think that we are already winning, you know, because we're going to have more options. We're going to have better experiences. There's going to be more convenience. And quite frankly, also, I think better prices because customers will pay a premium for certain experiences for sure, whether that's online or offline. But at the same time, I think there's going to be a lot more competition for having the best price or offering the best value. And retailers will keep each other kind of accountable as they compete in this new world. So I do think that customers are the ones who are going to win.
Denise Lee Yon is a restaurant and retail consultant and the author of What Great Brands Do. Denise, thanks so much for joining us today.
Lauren, thank you so much.
On a Saturday earlier this year, an estimated 15,000 people strolled along a busy stretch of 7th Avenue in Phoenix. The road was closed to traffic between Indian School and Camelback Roads for the annual Melrose on 7th Avenue Street Fair. But most people attending had no idea how a small, determined group made it happen. KJZZ's Christina Estes told us more back in March.
What's up, Melrose?
To fully appreciate the Melrose on 7th Avenue Street Fair, with its music stage and classic car show,
and you want the white rice?
14 food trucks, and 150 vendor booths, you have to go back 16 years to the first fair.
We had the six tables in the middle of the intersection at Glen Rosa and 7th Avenue, and we'd close down the street just like we did this time.
Lisa Huggins Hubbard is with Phoenix's Neighborhood Services Department.
Nothing like that had ever been done outside of the downtown area.
As patrol cars blocked 7th Avenue, media helicopters swirled overhead, reporting some kind of police activity and advising people to avoid the area.
My mother called me and said, are you okay? There's this horrible thing that happened at Glen Rosa and 7th Avenue. And I said, that horrible thing's me. You know, we're doing a street fair with, you know, 50 people out here.
The first street fair came after the 7th Avenue Merchants Association formed. David Cook is a former board president. 20 years ago, he says, a handful of business owners became fed up with vacant lots, rundown properties, and questionable characters.
They just said, hey, you know, the city's not helping us at the moment. We got to take back our businesses and take back our street.
That's where Lisa Huggins Hubbard comes in again. Back then, she was in her 20s, brimming with energy and new to city government.
there was resistance. And I had a lot of people very early on in my career that said, why are you doing that? Don't do all that work out there. That's how people get out of town.
She kept pushing, and so did the Merchants Association. They received grants and partnered with ASU School of Architecture to add shade canopies, art panels, and brand the Melrose District.
A lot of people will call this neighborhood the Gayborhood. The businesses here have welcomed everybody here. And that's part of the uniqueness about the mile here, is being so diverse.
The one-mile corridor, once a hub for pawn shops and repair shops, now attracts people looking for antiques, mid-century furniture, and classic clothing. The transformation required the Merchants Association and Lisa Huggins Hubbard to push again. This time they created what's called an overlay district.
It was a huge deal because it was never done before at the city.
The overlay established development standards.
The community said, here are the kinds of businesses that we want, here are the things that we don't want, and here's what we'll support.
Our pastries are so good.
Support for local businesses is as strong as a double espresso at Copper Star Coffee.
There are other neighborhoods in Phoenix. This is a community.
Bill Sandwig lives in the community and opened the coffee shop a dozen years ago.
We've spent $1.7 million on wages, generated over $1 million in money to local goods and services.
I can help the next customer in line.
Sandwig has been called the poster child for adaptive reuse. He encountered plenty of challenges.
Just random crazy things.
As he worked to get city approval to turn a greasy transmission shop into a gourmet coffee house.
So now they've really streamlined a lot of these processes and made it a little bit more business friendly. But I guess I was one of the last ones to go through under the old system.
He can laugh now and take satisfaction in knowing his success has helped attract more businesses. Soon, a vintage furniture showroom will open in a building that once housed a dry cleaner, and a restaurant and wine bar will replace a drive-through liquor store.
There's a couple of folks that caught me today that said, we want to move our business on the street.
It's not something Lisa Huggins Hubbard could have imagined so many years ago when the first fair led to confusing media reports.
You know, everybody will laugh and tell you that this is my baby, and it is.
She knows a 16-year-old isn't technically a baby, but like any proud mother, it's her prerogative to call it what she wants. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
So, Steve, you know when you go to visit a relative, they start pulling out the old photo albums?
Oh, I can't wait to see those sepia-toned photos of young Mark.
Oh, man, those are fantastic. Well, so if Park Central Mall were a person, it would be going through basically that same thing right now. When the current owners of the property peered into the mall's basement, they found a bunch of photo albums and other items all about this mall.
From baby Park Central to teenage Park Central. It was like a ready-made museum collection spanning decades of the mall's existence. The developers passed it on to ASU historians who are combing through it now. The show's Annika Klein has this preview.
When we flip through these different scrapbooks, it's really like a time capsule.
ASU history professor Matt Dalmont is looking through just a few of 20 scrapbooks that have barely been touched in decades. The pages are filled with clippings about Park Central Mall, a new store opening, a family-friendly event.
Usually people don't think about the history of a mall being something you would hold on to. And so I think we were lucky that it was kind of stashed away and forgotten in the basement. So now we have a chance to go through it and try to understand this moment in Phoenix's history.
It's a moment that began in 1957 when Park Central Mall was boldly opened north of downtown Phoenix on farmland. Phoenicians today know it as Midtown.
And people were actually worried when they considered the mall that would people go that far north to go shopping?
They did. Goldwater's and Diamond's department stores migrated from downtown Phoenix to become the mall's anchors. And in between the stores was a space where it seemed like anything could happen. Dalmont points to an image from the 60s.
There's a U.S. Air Force fighter jet parked directly outside of Park Central Mall. This is the height of the Cold War, where the U.S. is competing against Soviet Russia. But they have both a Titan missile and an Air Force jet outside of the mall.
Because why not marvel at the military's prowess before you buy a new handbag? There were all kinds of sensational events like this to draw people to the outdoor mall. The newspaper ads hype up a giant balloon parade, jetpack demos, hula hoop competitions, baby chicks riding a tiny Ferris wheel, a diver jumping into flaming water, and an annual pigeon race.
I can only imagine that they had a series of racing pigeons flying around the parking lot. The prize was a his and hers set of matched Volkswagens, which is a pretty good prize.
The historians quickly realized how many Phoenicians had passed through this mall at one point or another. They decided to go beyond the scrapbooks and see what else they could learn from the people who lived this history.
Really, there was no place else that had all this in it, in one spot, you know.
Irma Jepson was a shopper at Park Central from the time it opened. More than 50 years later, we're sitting together in the mall's lower level. Jepson just finished recording her memories for the oral history part of the ASU project.
My mother and my sister and I used to come here and shop a lot. It was an all-day thing. We came when we shopped, and we had dinner there, or lunch there. And sometimes they had fashion shows.
Jepson remembers how her husband would tease her for ordering the liver and onions at a restaurant called the Geronimo Room. And when she was a teacher, she brought her students here on field trips.
And I had my kids line up and talk to Santa Claus. He was usually sitting on a throne right in the middle of Park Central.
She says some of those kids had probably never been to a mall before, and they took in every detail with wide eyes. These small anecdotes are treasured by Matt Delmont and the other historians.
It's really a story of everyday history. I think that's what's so valuable about it, is that it's very hard to get a sense of how do people dress, what did they drink, what did they wear, where did they shop, where did Phoenicians spend their time?
By the mid-1960s, the answer to that last question became more varied. Park Central Mall had competitors, and they had air conditioning. Still, the mall kept up appearances.
We kept the floors clean. We kept the ashtrays clean, strained them with a wire strainer.
It was one of Mike Larson's first jobs in high school, a step up from paperboy. Larson worked here in the early 70s with some of his classmates.
A lot of good memories. We did the sign changing, and you know, sometimes we'd misspell something. Even though it was given to us on paper, we'd get the call saying, hey, you know, you got that letter wrong. So, okay, we'd go fix it.
The marquee signs have changed countless times since that gig, and the mall stopped being much of a mall in the 90s. But just being back here within these walls has Larson reeling memories in like fish on a line.
When we'd all have to come shop with Mom, Dad would go into Smuggler's Inn, and that's where he would spend his time while we shopped.
Today, a few businesses and a temporary branch of the city library are open during construction. Most of the time, the parking lot is just a parking lot. But the current owner has big plans to turn the location into something that speaks to this decade. A tech workspace with community gathering areas and art galleries. It's expected to be completed late this year. Irma Jepson is glad to see the building and its past are being preserved.
I think you just need to know history a little bit. It wasn't one of my favorite subjects in school because I didn't care about all that old stuff either when I was young. But now I learned to appreciate this old stuff.
She points at herself when she says this and smiles. The historians plan to show the stories to the public this spring. It'll be another event for the Park Central History Books. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
Photos of Park Central memorabilia will be up on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. This is The Show, and today we're giving you stories that tie into the holidays at hand. Now let's turn to family, and this next conversation has to do with ways that make loved ones comfortable as they age.
For octogenarians and others of an advanced age who suffer from Alzheimer's disease, their most positive memories have often happened between the ages of 10 and 30. And that time period rests somewhere in the 1950s. Lining up with that is the concept of memory towns. One of them is called Town Square, based in Chula Vista, California, outside of San Diego. The town has been designed to include more than a dozen different storefronts, including a diner, a movie theater, a park-like square, and a city hall. Scott Tardy is the chief executive officer of the Glenner Alzheimer's Family Center and a driving force behind Town Square, and he's with me. Scott, you've got a number of participants in just the couple of months you've been doing this. How do you know whether someone is going to have a positive or a negative reaction to this Town Square concept?
You know, I think what ends up being with reminiscence therapy, and this is independent research, not Glenner research, but when you take tangible prompts from people's past, whether that be something as simple as a photograph, or if you have something more elaborate like our environment here, where we actually have an immersive environment with, you know, a 1959 T-Bird and, you know, various storefronts that would be familiar to someone. We know that reminiscence therapy reduces agitation, it improves mood, and improves sleep quality because you're bringing people typically back to a time and surrounding them with prompts that are favorable to them. So I think when it comes to favorable or not favorable, I think what we end up trying to do is focus on the things that we know are meaningful to that particular participant and giving them the opportunity to engage fully with those things that would be more positive for them personally.
Is there a structure built in? Do you know how much time each person would benefit from having in the town square concept? For some, is it they really get absorbed in it for a while? But is there some sort of training to say, well, this person's going to do an hour a day or whatever it may be?
So the way that it's an excellent question. The way that the program works is that family members drop their loved ones off for 4 to 8 hours per day. So some family members, depending on their own schedules, can come twice a week, three times a week, five times a week. So it really depends, and we're really built to cater to the family caregivers. But of course, we want to make sure that the experience is beneficial and positive for the participant. So I think what it ends up being is a lot of active communication going back and forth between the families and our team to make sure that the experience is consistent with what the family members are looking for, and of course is consistent with what would be beneficial for the participant. But I will tell you that I think that the stimulation ends up being positive in almost every case that we see, because what ends up happening is, you know, this is engagement. This is reducing isolation. This is reducing the time where participants would not be otherwise engaging with other people and in specialized activities. So we don't hear a lot of pushback or kind of negative response, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. because we're really trying to cater to, you know, what are the needs of the participant and their family.
And Scott, one of the great concerns outside of the loved one's health is, are there enough people who are trained to help them get the most benefit out of this that they can? And as we're seeing more and more people live longer, more and more people hit with dementia or Alzheimer's, there is the concern that are there enough people to care for them, not just as a body, but really care for them in a proper way, and in this case, a very specific way, potentially. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I think one of the most exciting things about Town Square and our go-forward plans is that we've partnered at a national level with Senior Helpers, who provides in-home care throughout the country. They actually have 300 locations in 41 states. And we have a strategic partnership with Senior Helpers where they're actually providing the staffing inside of Town Square. So it's a wonderful opportunity to tap into their knowledge and expertise, because they have unique training that they go through with Tipa Snow, who's a national educator on Alzheimer's and other related dementias. And we're able to incorporate the use of Town Square, our professional expertise over the last 3.5 decades, and their caregiver network, professional caregiver network, to really create this experience that is consistent throughout the country as we expand.
Scott, I was wondering about this, because not everyone had the same exact experience, though, as you mentioned, between 10 and 30 years old, there is perhaps a real similar experience. But can this appeal to a broad swath of people? Because there are some who didn't have that sort of traditional town square. Can it be made so it's comfortable and familiar for people who didn't actually have that specific experience?
It absolutely can. And the way that we do that, we have participants from a very diverse background. We have Hispanic participants. We have participants that are Filipino, Vietnamese, Chinese. It's fascinating because the team that we have here develops programming that really speaks to the various participants that we serve. So I always look at the storefronts as backdrops. So whether it's in the museum again, or the library, or we have a sports pub, these are all backdrops for activities to occur in. So we can do them in, you know, multiple languages. We can do various activities that speak to someone's background when the time that they grew up in. And I really truly believe that Town Square is an international model. The numbers are absolutely overwhelming, and we do need to do something that creates options for families that are not only residential options.
Scott Tardy is the Chief Executive Officer of the Glenner Alzheimer's Family Center and a creator of Town Square.
The senior prom is the last hurrah of high school before students throw grad caps into the air and start a new chapter in life. But recently, the Phoenix Art Museum had a different take on the senior prom for adults 60 years and older.
It had the decor and the corsages and the photos, but there was also bingo and a 1950s cover band called Come Back, Buddy. Oh, and it started at 3 p.m. The show's Annika Klein went and asked people there to look back on their high school prom.
Hi, I'm Harriet Actman.
Every time I see you looking my way, baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat?
Senior prom back then in the 60s was held in the high school gym. Everybody was excited because the gym was decorated with balloons and crepe paper and looked very festive. And dinner was prepared by parents, and it was just set up on long tables.
You're the one I love.
Eloise Weatherall. I remember my senior prom very well. Even though it was 63 years ago, I couldn't get a date, and so I had a girlfriend who really wanted me to go, and her friend Charlie Westergreen couldn't get a date, so she told him to ask me, so we met in the hallway, and he asked me, and I said yes, and that was it until the night of the prom.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Bum, 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 bum.
Make him the cutest that I've ever seen.
Bum, 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 they arrived, he had a limo. Charlie had a flask with him, and he proceeded to start drinking until he got so drunk and was trying to kiss me, and it was so sloppy I couldn't handle it. So he happened to follow me into the ladies' locker room. So I grabbed him and put him in a locker and slammed the door and left and enjoyed the prom.
Bum, 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 bum. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over.
Hi, I'm Sandy.
Oh, yes, I'm Ed, and I went to school on Long Island, as they pronounce it back there.
Gosh, I don't remember what I wore, who I went with. I must not have liked it.
There was a hit song. It was Earth Angel, and they used to do this dance that was, the girls would really swing their hips, and I don't know what they call it, but it was provocative, to say.
Earth Angel, will you be mine?
Oh my God, did they have chaperones? Remember that? Oh, holy cow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we made out in the cars. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That I remember. Yeah, I know.
My prom date and I, who I'm still in touch with, we had just a wonderful time, and just it was the glue that kept the class going. As friends forever.
We've been dancing since we got here, since 3 o'clock, yeah.
Being that it's an older crowd, everybody seems to be comfortable in their own skin. And they're not looking around seeing how people dance. They're just flinging around and listening to the music that makes their bones rustle. Really nice.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Michael McClanathan. I'm giving a lesson to my grandson, Colton Wagner. It's a little more air on that bottom one. And starting at a young age is always a key. It takes about a year on this practice chanter before you're ready to get onto the bagpipes themselves. Okay, good. One, two. For quite a while, you're still going to sound like you're squeezing a cap. You know, it's not going to be pretty at first. That's it. After playing for quite a long time, it becomes a part of you, and becomes my voice for things, you know. So.
That's Michael McClanathan teaching his grandson Colton Wagner how to play the bagpipes at his Scottish import store. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we're full of hot air, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
You are listening to The Show, and since Black Friday is already a little weird in and of itself, let's take a look at the wilder side of the great American West. What happens when a writer from New Mexico, who's taught poetry in Arizona and is now living in the Deep South, explores the people and places of the Wild West? The show's Paige Phelps has the story.
The American West. There's a lasting mystique of the cowboy, the border, the wide open spaces. The West has been chronicled in every medium possible for the invisible pull it has on people around the world. And it's in this spirit that author Josh Wheeler wrote his collection of essays called Acid West. The New Mexican native, he's from Alamogordo, says he pulled from an entire arsenal of you-can't-make-this-up true stories from the state, which he says are really part of his identity.
Well, I think I just wanted to capture what it was like there, which often feels surreal. You have this sort of layering of frontiers, like a lot of places, but it's particularly evident there. You have the Native American identities with the Mescalero Apaches, then you have all of the nostalgia about the Old West and the stories of Billy the Kid, and then on top of that, you have sort of the military-industrial complex, which started to come in the 1930s and 1940s, and then most famously testing the first atomic bomb. That's one of the things I wanted to capture, and certainly one of the things that I think lends to that surreal nature.
And if the strangest thing you know about New Mexico is a TV show featuring blue meth known as Breaking Bad.
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger.
Wheeler says that's okay. Breaking Bad, he says,
I think really introduced a lot of people to how interesting and strange New Mexico is.
In his book Acid West, Wheeler writes about the military's drone training program in New Mexico because the landscape is similar to the Middle East. He explores aliens and UFOs in the odd little town of Roswell, and he writes about the Red Bull Stratos jump. You might remember this one. When a man named Felix Baumgartner parachuted to Earth from space to prove that humans could survive free-falling through the sound barrier. Or, as they call it in New Mexico, another day that ends in Y.
So there's all sorts of sort of strange stories, but it's all true. And it's all me trying to make sense of why it doesn't always seem like it's real life.
Although Wheeler laughs that weirdos are everywhere, his book approaches his subjects with earnest curiosity and prose. Take, for example, his essay on the Downwinders. Those are residents who live near Los Alamos who are trying to organize and ask for reparations from the government. They were exposed to fallout from the first test of the atomic bomb. Here's a clip.
And what he remembers most is that his mama had laundry hanging on the line to dry. He remembers the laundry blowing in the wind. Kind of strange to have wind like that right before dawn. All her white stuff, he says. Linens and shirts and underwear flapping around. And then the flash. On the polished steel of the Ford's grill and the dull steel of the bucket and the flapping white linens and the retinas of little Henry's eyes. Light. Night turned to day, he says. Like heaven came down. And after a few minutes comes this little flimsy dust. Fine dark ash just came down and landed all over everything. Mama's clothes hanging out there turned nearly black, so she had to wash them all over again. He laughs at the thought of his mama's face, seeing all her whites turn to grays, screaming, "What the hell did you explode out here, Henry?" So that's the story of how Henry's mama tried to blame him for the atomic bomb. It's funny until you know he was drinking it and eating it and everything else. But we didn't know that for years. Not really until we started dying.
Like most things in the West, beauty is abundant. But a closer look always shows life in a hard-fought, precarious battle. Beautiful things can prick you here. And people connected to the West wear it like a second skin. Josh Wheeler knows this. He's currently teaching in Louisiana.
I very much like it in New Orleans and think I could spend a lot of time here. But New Mexico is really home for me, and I really feel whenever I'm there that I'm where I'm supposed to be. So one day, hopefully, I can figure out a way to get back to New Mexico.
Next up for the writer, another essay about New Mexico and a filmmaker who was working there in 1910.
He made a lot of really strange westerns. They were kind of psychedelic and trippy.
Yup. Looks like another New Mexico day that ends in Y. For the show, I'm Paige Phelps.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.